I'm gonna cheat a lot and let you know when I do it, so you can actually take that as a homework to make the thing neat. So by now you guys have had quite an intense overview of this CHY scattering equation formalism. Am I right? Right. So I'd like to. I mean, you've also seen that it's. You've also had a string theory class and had MBTwister lectures. So you may be wondering about the connection between the formalisms, because they both seem to be stringy formalisms. So are they connected or not? And actually, I'll start with one important reason you should think they are connected, which is this scattering equation formalism. Just the scattering equations themselves, which I will rewrite for you. Which govern the scattering amplitude of field theory, like you've seen, but they also happen to govern the high energy behavior of string theory somehow. So have you heard about that or not at all? Right, I'll take that as a no. So
yes, the limit of alpha prime going to infinity.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you did. Okay. Cool. So let me just recap the story, because I'm going to start out telling you it's a sort of paradox, and then hopefully work through to fix that paradox and give a global, consistent, hopefully consistent picture of the story. So, so we have massless field theories, like, what? All right, how to do this?
Oh, it's the panel in the middle.
Ah, okay. No, well, okay, cool.
It's set to be complicated.
Yeah. Okay, and I'll just find a way to not do it. Like supergravity or super Young Mills or whatever. And these things are obtained in a particular limit of string theory when alpha prime goes to zero. So, what is alpha prime? Alpha prime is the string length squared. The Rege parameter as well. And intuitively, it's clear that when you send the length of the string to zero, you kind of recover particles. A more rigorous way to phrase that is to see that string theory has a infinite tower of massive states. For the superstring, you'd start that mass squared equals zero. And then you'd go on. And the mass of these states is proportional to integer over alpha prime. So like in the bosonic string, something like 4n over alpha prime. And when you send alpha prime to zero, these states become infinitely heavy. And it's another way to see that they should kind of decouple and you remain with only field theory. So that's the traditional picture by which you recover field theory out of string theory. And then you have this other way of defining, of computing scattering amplitude based on these scattering equations. So let me say a few words about the high energy limit of string theory, just in case you don't recall why this has anything to do with high energy string theory. So, as I said, it's going to be low tech. So we start with our usual Polyakov action. In the conformal gauge. So I'm not, I will assume that you're sort of familiar with that, but And now we look, when we look at the partition function of our string theory, I'm ignoring ghosts and things. I'm just looking at the path integral of these maps to space-time, right? Just the x mu are fields with coordinates on the wall sheet that map to space-time. So when you look at the string theory partition function, it comes as, well, just the path integral of exponential minus the action, which I shall rewrite for you right now and erase from here. And the scattering amplitudes, you could think of as some small perturbation of the metric. I'm getting to vertex operators. So actually here, this x mu x nu is contracted with a space, with a target space metric. And in a background of, say, gravitons, in a graviton background, g mu nu is something like eta mu nu plus some sum of polarization, epsilon mu nu I, some polarizations with plane waves. So this is the wave function of our gravitons. Say we look at n graviton. So the idea is that you replace your metric by this expansion here, and you want to extract an amplitude at the end. So you take, we're going to expand this exponential and keep only the linear piece in these epsilons, because we know that the amplitude is some sort of product of polarizations, but like only the linear piece. I'm using some sort of a shortcut to get to vertex operators again. So expand and keep linear order in epsilons. So this is going to give you something that has a bunch of terms down there. But most importantly, it's got these exponentials, these plane waves. And still our action. And this is now contracted with the eta mu nu. Next step, I'm just plugging these guys in this exponential. Can I erase that? That's a yes. And when this guy comes in the exponential, you have something, well, you have this sum of kj.x. And they are located at some position zj on your wall sheet. So if you want to rewrite that as an integral, well, you're going to have to put z in some sort of delta function. So why am I telling you all that? Well, first off, if you're familiar with vertex operators and how you compute scattering amplitude in string theory, this is what you would have obtained using that formalism. I'm telling you all that because I want to get to these things, to these equations. And I told you about some alpha prime to infinity limit. I want to say, the common lore is that, right, you're going to localize on the classical solutions of the action, but this is not obvious when you look at that action. If you think of normal quantum mechanics, you'd have exponential minus 1 over h bar, and then your Euclidean action. So when h bar goes to 0, you indeed localize on the classical solutions, right? Here, there's a small worry here when you look at this 1 over alpha prime, because it doesn't go to zero. I'm trying to send it to infinity. But the thing is that the dimensions, the quantities are all a little bit mismatched in there. And you can't just send alpha prime to infinity because it's a dimension full parameter. You need to send a dimension less parameter to infinity. And what's the dimension less parameter we're looking at? It's just something like, well, it's alpha prime sine k squared. That's dimensionless because alpha prime is the square of a length. And k is like a typical energy scale for all scattering process. So you could think that we're, well, whatever the arrows really, but you could think that all our momenta are kind of rescaled by some parameter k. And then, sorry, when I put this one over, when I put all of this under that parenthesis, there's an alpha prime that comes in there. And then essentially what I'm telling you is that we should be having an alpha prime in front of it here, which means there's an alpha prime squared in there. Alpha prime is in front of it, so it disappears from there. And then when you do a change of variable for x, I just want to reabsorb all of these factors in x. So when you put x is alpha prime k times y, this is going to allow you to exactly factor out the quantity you want in there and re-express everything in terms of these y's. And now you can indeed take that, the limit in which that parameter becomes big, and you localize on a classical action. It took a little while, but I'm insisting on that because usually in the literature it's not presented quite quite clearly, and it may look confusing. So the moral is that sending alpha prime k squared to infinity implies the string localizes on the classical solution. And how do you get the classical solutions for that action? Well, you just vary the action in the presence of these plane waves, of these sources. So this just gives you something like dd bar x with a minus sign. Because you integrate by part, right? plus I times the sum of the kj delta 2 of z. This is the classical solution in this of this action in this background of plane waves. Now I do. I went back to x's. Yeah, I just used the y's over there, but to know that we. But this is just a matter of scale. Now I do mean x, just for simplicity. And then this classical solution is, as you can check, purely imaginary and is given by sum of the kj. So of course we have mu indices here and there. So this is the classical evolution of a string. I mean, in this background of plane waves, you can see that indeed, when on your world sheet, so z describes some coordinate on the world sheet, some local coordinate, and when z goes to one of these punctures, indeed that logarithm blows away. So you're going really far, and this is essentially this picture that. You're having your state scattered from asymptotic null infinity that go back to null infinity. So, what about these? I'm still not done with these. These are, these equations are, in this limit of alpha prime being large, are just the contents of these Virasoro constraints. Do you, I don't know, I've seen the notes of your string theory class. I'm not quite sure. Do you guys appreciate what are the Virasoro constraints? Or shall I insist a little bit on that? All right. So when you start with the Polyakov action engaged, so again, this 1 over 4 pi alpha prime, return in term, now I'm going to be very explicit, of wall sheet metric. That action has some symmetries, in particular, it's diffeomorphism invariant. So you're free to choose any coordinate system on your wall sheet. It's not going to change your theory. And in particular, this means that and this is a consequence of the fact that the wall sheet metric here is an auxiliary field, and the equation of motion for this metric give you the stress tensor, which should vanish for the theory to be diffeomorphism invariant. So diffeomorphism invariant is equivalent to the fact that the stress tensor should vanish. When you quantize the theory, that equation should be imposed as a constraint, and this is what determines the physical spectrum of your theory. So this tower that I drew here essentially comes from applying these constraints on your physical state. And it turns out that if you compute this variation, you can see explicitly that your stress tensor, T alpha beta, has, well, that you'll have to look it up because I'm not going to just redo the whole thing. But essentially, if we go to a light cone coordinates, sigma plus, sigma minus, which are just sigma plus minus tau, our stress tensor has just two components, T plus plus and T minus minus, which should be zero. And these components assume a rather simple expression. They're just given by D, so T plus plus is just D plus X, D plus X, and T minus minus, well, is D minus X, D minus X. And I've been, sorry, I'm realizing that I've been switching back and forth between Vic rotated Euclidean coordinate and Lorentzian coordinates. So the D bar over there was something like our D plus upon complexifying, upon Vic rotating, and the D minus was the other one. So if you look, where is it? Right. If you look at our classical solution, you can check, and you should check if that's of any interest to you, that T, say, plus plus classical, which is just now dx dx. Well, actually, there's nothing to check. It's fairly easy. This thing, when you differentiate by z, you just get something like the sum of the ki, kj, z minus zi, z minus zj. Up to factors of I minus. Just taking the d derivative of this log of z plus log z bar, and you just get 1 over. And when you do the product, you have the product of the 1 over and the k's contract. So this is our 0-0 conditions on the classical solution. And it turns out that to apply to for these to hold, essentially you demand that the poles of this function vanish, which is nothing but demanding that the scattering equations are enforced. So on the classical solution, okay, this one is just stuck, or?
Yeah, it doesn't work.
Right, anyway. Oh, come on. Moral, that was a rather pedestrian way to get there. For alpha prime k going to infinity, the 0-0 constraints equal the scattering equations. What does this buy us? Well, we're going to specify to, I'm going to show you what this action becomes now, because I've told you that the action localizes, so we should be able to just evaluate it. And let's look at 4-point. 4-point scattering. So we use the normal kinematic Mandelstam invariant. And U is the other one. So, homework. How shall I write that? Exercise. Show that integral of dx class d bar x class plus I sum of kj x class . So our classical action evaluated on the our 0-0 constraints is equal to alpha prime up to term s log s minus t log t plus, sorry, minus u log u. With these values here. And now, what I've told you is that if you take A, I haven't told you anything about what's in there, but it's irrelevant, because what's governing the scattering here is the saddle point that we're making. So the conclusion of that is that any string theory 222 string theory amplitude essentially scales like follow. not essentially, does scale A of ST, so it's S log S plus T log T plus U log U. So that's a remarkable observation that was made in the early days of dual models, that the string amplitudes are exponentially suppressed at high energies. In field theory, you just have power low suppression. In string theory, you have this striking fact that the amplitude decay exponentially. There's a few ways to see or to understand that aspect qualitatively. It's a sign that the string is an extended object because we're looking at a 2-to-2 process, right? So it's an exclusive process. It excludes all the other possibilities for the string. We're taking two strings and demand what's the amplitude for these two strings to decay to two other strings. And what that exponential suppression is kind of saying is that the string actually at high energy wants to break apart, so to break to more kind of strings and not just to two. So the allowed so the cross section, the amplitude, sorry, for doing only 2-to-2 should be very, very small because it's an extended object, so it wants to break apart. Right, so that was it for the bit of physics part. I just wanted to emphasize the fact here that alpha prime going to infinity describes some physics that's really intrinsically stringy from the string theory perspective. However, it's still based on the scattering equations, and we've been hearing a lot that the scattering equations do describe field theory. So how? Yeah.
When you have 2-to-n, do all these amplitudes with n bigger than 2 also decay exponentially?
Yeah. Yeah, they all behave like that. The string theory at high energy is a very rich playground for phenomenon, because then you also need to start wondering about the presence of D-brains and tons of many other phenomenon. So it's not like it's, I don't know what you have in mind, maybe some sort of resummation of the tree level processes or you could, yeah, so the short answer is yes.
The context is a bit away, so maybe not.
Say it again?
My context is a bit away.
So. Right, okay. So now we seem to have some paradox, and one may question whether or not it's pedagogical to emphasize so much the paradoxical aspect of something before giving the solution, but that's how I wanted to go along. The idea, spoil the pitch and give you directly the final sort of solution. The idea is that you have, when people present string theory, actually it's just something that wasn't really known. That was kind of discovered many times, a few times, and then forgotten. And people have not really appreciated it. But there is a quantization ambiguity to string theory. So there's always, there's always a question as to this arrow going from quantum to classical is a natural arrow in some sense, when you can define that limit. The other arrow is to some extent artificial, and you follow a prescription. But at some point, and you may remember your early quantum mechanics days, you have to make some decisions about how you order your operators. It turns out that in string theory, it's a big deal. So there is one way to do string theory, which is the classical way that everybody talks about, I mean, that everybody studies, and that describes actually this rich theory. So that gives you, I'm not sure how to call that. I'll call that conventional string theory here, because that's what Ori said in the title, conventional string theory. Turns out there's another way to do it that gives you a theory that's been not studied that much and is still, it's an active open research area that has many names. So for the moment, I'll just advocate for the name I like, but there's many in the literature. So I'll call this thing twisted strings. And then you have this alpha prime to infinity limit, whereby the string, I forgot to say also, alpha prime is connected to the, is equal to the inverse string tension. Right, so it was there. But 1 over 2 pi alpha prime is the tension of the string. So at alpha prime equals infinity, you get a string that's tensionless. And people have been trying to study these tensionless strings for quite some time, for actually one reason that I'm going to tell you in a second, which is that they're supposed to describe some higher spin theories, or some kind of unbroken phase of string theory. So when you look at the spectrum, which I erased, spectrum of string theory was made of these states with mass proportional to 1 over alpha prime. These states are massive higher spin states. They have higher spins, but they have mass, so they evade the standard no-goes. But when alpha prime goes to infinity, all of these states collapse to, or kind of want to collapse to this massless region here. And then you end up kind of describing something you would want to think of a higher spin, a theory of massless higher spins. Right, so there's a bunch of no-goes that kind of prevent that in flat space, so it's not quite clear what is string theory in this limit. That's why people wanted to study these tensionless strings. And I'm adding some interrogation marks because it's not actually known what this is. What is known, what is however known, and happens to be quite simple, is here you have the ambi-twisted string. Or the scattering equation, CHY stuff. So I assume that you guys are all familiar with this, with that object here. And then the solution to this paradox is that the connection doesn't go from conventional string theory to this ambi-twisted string. It goes, the conventional high spin string theory goes to whatever it goes to. There's another quantization of string theory that, when you take alpha prime to infinity, produces for you this CHY formalism. So that is a surprising, subtle, and still studied observation.
How else do they call these twisted strings?
Right, yeah, I'm going to give a bunch of references at the end of the class, but it's also called chiral strings, left-handed, sectorized. There's a bit of a name war going on here. The thing is that we realize that it's neither chiral nor left-handed, so I mean, there's some regimes in which it's neither of these things. Sectorized, yeah, but it's for different reasons. So, or whatever the name. I mean, it's just, and that string has a remarkable property that I'm going to describe right now. Also, I'll tell you about this quantization ambiguity. So let's quantize our string. We have our classical solutions. Equations of motion, dd bar x equals 0, which we interpret as saying that x is a sum of holomorphic left movers and anti-holomorphic right movers. And we do a Fourier expansion of these guys. X left is some zero mode plus some momentum zero mode, tau. Tau and sigma are now our coordinates on the, just for the record, I'm calling now z is exponential. So this is still a Lorentzian picture. I'm not saying that z bar is the conjugate of z, right? This would be the case when we Vic rotate the time. All I will say is you can say it in this Lorentzian signature. So while I'm not sure about. It's not clear if you can use a Euclidean picture for that. So, it's probably a factor of 1/2 and some sort of square root of alpha prime. Alpha prime. 1/(α)). Okay, whatever. I'm not trying to get the factors right. Except this one. No. Alpha n. So this z is just our Fourier variable, right? And x right has also this zero mode part. We can add just 1/2 just to be not too uncomfortable. Alpha n tilde over n z tilde minus n. And before even telling you about the constraints and all of that, I'm going to jump directly to how you build your Fock space. When you quantize, you when you quantize, you promote your fields to operators with, say, hats, but I'm going to forget about the hats quite quickly. And actually, I should have told you about Poisson brackets. So you'd get, because you want your Poisson bracket to go to 1/i commutators. So you'd get your Poisson bracket by introducing a canonical momentum canonically conjugated to x, dtx, which just happens to be the time derivative of x by these Poisson bracket. You would, by declaring this to be your canonical Poisson bracket, you could compute your, the Poisson brackets of these individual fields, alpha n's. And eventually, when you do that quantization prescription, you obtain your following algebra, the following Heisenberg algebra. And of course, there's mu and mu's everywhere. So, where are we? This is one. So these guys are a bunch of harmonic oscillators, and you want some of them to be creation operators and some of them to be annihilation operators. Typically, you take the creation operators to have positive energy. So I got signs wrong everywhere. It should have been pluses here. So now we have a minus in here, which means that the energy is the conjugate variable to time. So the creation operators should be, I mean, it's something that's usually just, I'm spending time on something that's usually just skimmed through like super quickly, and that probably have prevented the possibility of what I'm going to say to rise in your mind. So creation operators are the alpha minus n and alpha tilde minus n for n positive, and the annihilation operators are the one with positive n. What does that mean? It means that the states, the excited states of the string, the vibration modes, are of the form alpha minus n 1 mu 1 blah blah blah, alpha tilde minus m 1 mu 1 blah blah blah, acting on some vacuum states. And that the alpha n with n positive annihilate the vacuum. Equivalently, this defines a normal ordering, an operator ordering. Whereby you put the annihilation operators on the right. Well, it turns out it's only important when m is different from minus n, because otherwise this guy commutes, so you don't really care. Do you still see anything here? I'm just going to lift this up in a second. And the same for the tilted things. So, damn it. Can I write that? Right. So, during string theory classes, people don't usually spend lots of time on that, because it's all fairly straightforward. It's just quantizing harmonic oscillators, and actually, The reason why I'm spending time on that is because there's another possibility. And if I mention that to you, maybe you may actually even have a guess, although I'm not sure if it's obvious or not. The sort of guess you could find. It's probably hard to just have an idea. So the other possibility is to twist you could twist both of them, but it would just amount to be the same. If you can twist one sector as follow. Don't change alpha prime, don't change the alpha untilded. But take alpha tilde n creation and alpha tilde minus n annihilation. So when you see that, you may think like, why not? Is that really such a big deal? What does it do? Then if you consider it longer, using the analysis of the constraints that I may or may not going to, depending on time, if you consider it longer, you may be like, well, terrible idea. Probably not sounds good, doesn't work, but like no way to work because something is gonna go wrong, you're not changing that commutator, and you're going to create loads of negative norm states. So why is that? What's that negative norm state business? So already in the normal string, when you do, I'm not sure exactly what type of quantization did you do with Davide? Was it directly BRST, or did you do like light cone quantization, or just BRST? All right. So when you do the what's called in textbook, like in Green-Schwarzschild, and what's called all canonical quantization, which is pretty much what I'm doing here. You do encounter this negative norm state quite from the start, because so already in the normal setting, because say if you look at a state that has one excitation, so in the open string, that would be in the open string. That guy can be zero as well. And when you look at the norm of alpha zero, that's essentially proportional to eta zero zero, that's minus one. So that's bad news. That's this negative norm state. Just spoil the unitarity of the theory. You can't have this usual probabilistic interpretation of your theory. It means unitarity is broken. So there is a prescription to get rid of them in the normal setting, which is apply the constraint. Apply the zero zero constraint. And then this proves for you a bunch of things: that the string lives in 26 dimensions, and that it's a proper unitary string, and that it has the spectrum that I told you about before. So that would get rid of this longitudinal, temporal polarization for, say, a gauge boson. And now, if you're doing this, if you're considering these guys with a with a reversed, okay, I should not elaborate long on that, but essentially because you reversed that and did not change this, you're going to have loads of minus signs that could crop up in the norm of your states. And as we'll see in an example later, these indeed create potentially negative norm sets. So you could be like, after having given it a little bit more thought, totally wrong idea, no way I'm getting anywhere with this. But it turns out that there is some kind of a miracle that happens. That's connected. I don't know, did Davide kind of trick you with the sum of integers or? No? No? You didn't? Okay, so he was honest. Because usually it's one easy way to actually I think you have to do it even in the BRST quantization to get the the quantization of the string right. Usually when you follow the say textbook approach, at some point you encounter an infinite sum of integers, and you use zeta. You know, people use nice words about that, and eventually mumble, and then you get to -1/12, and then, and then, aha, -1/12, 26 dimensions. So, to be honest, it's actually not that much of a cheat, and there's a very clean way to actually understand that differently from having to do this sum of integers. Which is to check the closure of the Lorentz algebra. Not going to go into that at all. Anyway, let's see where this trick comes in. It comes in when we look at this, or constraints here. So I'll be done in like 10 minutes. Did we? Yeah, is that right?
Okay. Officially, yeah. I mean. Officially in 10 minutes, but I think there's a little bit of extra degree of freedom.
Ah, right. I'll keep it 10, so yes, long day. So, right, I told you about these constraints, and I told you before that they are supposed to determine your physical spectrum for you. So what does that mean? It means that these things I'm writing very carelessly as products of... Where are they? Oh, here. Like, this thing here, they are... Our physical state need to be killed by the constraints. So somehow our T plus plus and T minus minus should be now applied on our physical state as operators. And again, why is that? It's because our string was classically diffeomorphism invariant, which meant that its stress tensor should vanish. So when you quantize all your business, you need to apply these guys on your physical states. So instead of applying these the objects themselves as operators, we're going to look at their Fourier expansions. And the Fourier expansion of this guy is like sum of the over n of some ln zn. Ln bar, z bar, maybe minus. So these guys generate the Virasoro algebra that you may have heard about in either the CFT class in the string class maybe. And they have the following expression. Ln is the sum of in Z, M in Z of alpha M minus N, M minus N. Same for tilde, right? Oli, you disagree?
Maybe you switch the M's and N's on the right-hand side.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry, I'm summing over M. Minus plus. Yeah, right.
Okay.
Sorry. Thanks. Same for tilde. That's classical. When you quantize, you get this double dot thing. And actually, when n is different from m, these alphas commute anyway, because I recall you, alpha n is n delta n plus n. So, so actually, I don't even need, because they commute, I don't need to wonder about how to put them in order, right? Except for one guy, L0, that is given by the sum of alpha minus n, m, alpha m, and L0 tilde. And then, long story short, because in this in doing this ordering, you may you do generate some constant term. Usually, there is what is called the normal ordering ambiguity in there. Ordering constants. There's many ways to see that the solution of the whole thing is a equal a bar equals one. Right now I'm going to cheat a lot. No, I want to. this is too wrong. So anyway, the final result is that L0 is something like the sum of alpha minus n, alpha n minus 1. Sorry, for n bigger than 0, bigger than 1. L0 bar, sorry, there's a zero mode piece as well, alpha 0 squared. And L0 bar is pretty much the same. This is just normal string theory. So for this, many different ways to see. Many ways to see that. And for your own curiosity, you may want to revise them or look them up in textbooks. So. Right. We're going to see how we get to the spectrum from these guys. This alpha zero here is the zero mode, which means it's a term coming from z to the zero in this business. And if I hadn't, again, managed to erase the mode expansion of x, we would have seen that this is pretty much just, this is essentially p squared, the momentum of our string, the factor of alpha prime over 2. So the constraint that determine our physical spectrum are that L0 plus minus L0 bar should be 0. Okay, this is our 0-0 conditions. What do they? N is bigger. Is just bigger than one here. Before it was in Z. Now it's just bigger than one. How does that work? Well, first off, what's this operator? you should actually, I'm gonna leave that as a do it yourself. That's sum of alpha minus n, alpha n is a number operator. That is, it just counts the number of alphas. So this is, this I'm gonna call n, and this I'm gonna call n bar. Counts the number of n of alpha bars. So these two conditions now we rewrite as follow. When we take the difference, these minus one just die off. This constant term here, that's proportional to the momentum of the string, just die off, and you get that n is equal to n bar. This is called level matching, which tells you that your physical states have as many left movers as right movers. And then what about the other condition? It tells you that alpha prime over 4p squared plus n bar minus 2 is equal to 0, which you rewrite as alpha as m squared is n minus 1 times 4 over alpha prime. I'm just using n equal n bar, get a factor of 2. I don't know why I ended up having a factor of 4 here. There was a 1. And whatever. That's the, I'm sorry, I'm just, this is 2, so this should be a 2 here. I don't know why I screwed up over there. Maybe these should have been 4s, actually, right? Reverse engineering. So anyway, that's the mass spectrum of our bosonic string, okay? The one I told you about before. I'm sorry, it's that far on the. And now, this tells you that you have an infinite tower of massive states. You can also look at the spin of the states. You find lots of nice properties. In particular, you have Rege behavior of your string theory. And that's it. That's your string theory. Now let's look at the twisted version. Twisted, so L0 doesn't change. And L0 bar. Let's see what it goes like. This is where I'm going to cheat. L0 bar is still alpha prime p squared over 4. Now, I'm having this sum over there. I want to switch it, right? So I want to write it in terms of alpha tilde n, alpha tilde minus n. I can do that. I just need to add the commutator. Alpha minus. Minus 1. This is minus n times, because these guys have mu and mu here, times d minus 2. So this is one cheat. I'm mixing up two different approaches, and I'm not telling you about ghosts. Essentially, you can understand that because this is the transverse modes. This is the physical modes. But transverse physical modes. And then you end up with an infinite sum of these guys. You end up with d minus 2 minus sum of the integers. So again, well, there we go. This is d minus sum of the integers is minus 1 over 12, but And so this is minus d minus 2 times minus 1 over 12. By the way, there's a cute way to see that, which is to look at the zeta function. If you look at 1 over n to the s, this is the sum of 1 over n to the s. This is zeta of s. And it turns out that zeta of minus 1 is just minus 1 over 12. I mean, it's fine. It's actually, it's you if you didn't know that, you should look it up. It's a rather cute phenomenon. Plot it on Mathematica, you'll see that it's just going to minus 1 over 12 smoothly. So, right, so d equal 26, that's a 24. Minus minus, that's a plus 2. So this is where there's a sort of warning for... But that, you know, it's a shortcut, but this is indeed the result of a more proper analysis. So the plus 2 compensate the minus 1 to give a plus 1. And then what do we get? When we look at L0 minus L0 bar... sorry, I forgot to say one thing. You're going to have to take my word on that. This guy here, before I was telling you that this stuff over there is just a number operator, and you should check it yourself, I told you to. Now you should actually check yourself that this is minus some sort of a twisted number operator. And it's minus because since we haven't changed the commutation relation, we're picking up a minus sign when we count the number of alphas. Alpha tildes, sorry. So check this. And I shouldn't be writing this in this deserted area of the blackboard. But down here. So when we look at L0 minus L0 bar, we get a condition that writes n plus n bar twisted minus 2 equals 0. Why is that? Well, we're taking the L0 over there. Damn. That has an n. This guy has a minus n bar, so when we take the minus, we get a plus. And the normal ordering ambiguities are minus 1, minus 1 gives a total minus 2. Which tell you that now that you should have that the sum of the alpha and alpha tilde operators should be 2 and not like equal. So because these guys are integers, just for a final contribution of you guys to your day. I don't know, you're done today or do you have more stuff? Like lectures or tutorials? No, okay, you're done. So last effort. What are the solutions of that equation for these guys, positive integers? Right, shouldn't take too long, right? Come on, someone. Sorry, 1, 1, yep, and?
2002.
2002, right. Cool. So that's all, that's the only states that are allowed in your theory. So compared to string theory that had an infinite number of states, now you have 3. So you're like, oh, well, all right, that's kind of different. And indeed, if you look at L0 plus L0 bar now, you do get a similar mass formula that now tells you that m squared is 2 over alpha prime n minus n bar twisted. From which you can also get the masses of these states. So that state has mass 0, and these guys have mass, well, something like plus minus 4 over alpha prime. Minus 4, so that's a tachyon. So let's not worry too much about that. It's a bosonic string. It has a tachyon. More worryingly, these states have negative norm. So, which means that they are ghosts. Because both of them have two oscillators, they behave like some stuff that has, you know, alpha mu, alpha nu, or with tildes. But anyway, it has two Lorentz indices, so they look like spin twos. So you have three spin two in your theory. You may be like, okay, but bad news. Worse than that, two of them are massive, so you get, I mean, worse or not, depending on your point of view on massive gravity, but you get a theory of massive gravity that has also a graviton, and this guy is a tachyon. So, all right, it's a pretty, without being too, conservative, it's fair to say that it's pretty sick. The good news, however, and the miracle, is that when you do supersymmetric versions of that business, these guys are actually killed, so you don't even have them. So this is supersymmetric, like RNS, for instance, the RNS formalism. And then you get only the spectrum of your string theory is only gravity, and it actually turns out to be supergravity. And then you have this strange object that's a string theory. It has this parameter alpha prime everywhere, but it doesn't depend on alpha prime because it has only states of zero mass. So there's no alpha prime. This is the spectrum of our string. It's there. There's nothing here. And it's remarkable. It really just describes gravity. So what's at this point you may be like, okay, well, that's strange. Because we know that string theory describes, at least provides a UV completion for gravity theories. What about that? You told us about the string theory. It describes only gravity. Does it mean that this theory is UV complete or not? Well, open question, probably not. It looks like it's just a conservative point of view of that is that this provides a new representation of scattering amplitudes. So I haven't told you how that is connected in any manner to the scattering equations before. And I'm going to end on a very shortcut, a very quick description of that. Before, when we had, can you read on that? Like, yeah. Before, when we had all of these massive states of masses proportional to 1 over alpha prime, when alpha prime was sent to infinity, everything would collapse here, and we would have the scattering amplitude governed by our Virasoro constraints. If you remember the very beginning of it, and these Virasoro constraints. At alpha prime goes to infinity, the Virasoro equal the scattering equations. Well, now you're going to have to take my word for granted, but the sort of the amplitudes you would compute in this framework also have this property. Also here, scattering equations govern alpha prime going to infinity. However, there's no alpha prime. So you send alpha prime to infinity, and there you go. So I'm sorry, I'm aware that I'm going a bit quick on that. If you want to learn more about that, Sebastian, who's actually now sitting here in the back of the room, could tell you more cool stuff, and in particular about the math that's involved in that operation here. Just to finish on one thing, when I told you this to do this do-it-yourself check that you get something like alpha prime s log s plus t log t plus u log u for normal string theory. came because our classical trajectory was this sum of log of z minus zi modulus square, which means that we're doing this plus the complex conjugate. And now, because we have done this change of ordering, sorry, I'm kind of cheating here as well. It's not quite because, but essentially you'd find that here you have a minus sign between these two contributions. And then these two phases would more or less cancel. And instead of adding up to these, they would cancel, and then you would get exponential minus alpha prime of zero, which is compatible with the high energy behavior of a field theory amplitude. It's not decaying exponentially. It's multiplying some mass in both cases. And that mass that it's multiplying is the supergravity amplitude. So this is just for you to not to see how that phase, or to have some sort of a picture of how that phase disappears and does not spoil the high energy behavior. Well, first off, I told you there's no alpha prime to start with, so you're not expecting anything like that. And second, there's the way these phases disappear, if you want to delve into it, is connected to some minus sign that appears, that comes from this change of creation and annihilation operators. It's all a bit vague, but at least you have some clues to dig out the connection. And that's it. I'm just gonna write down a few references. Do you want references or? Yeah. So I'm gonna go backward in time. There's a paper by. Can I upload them on the website in some manner or?
Well, we could.
Right. Okay. I'll do that. It's gonna be easier. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions. Piotr is around until Friday lunchtime, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
Okay, so feel free to grab them.